This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest today is a fellow Fresh Air contributor, John Powers, our critic at large. He's just back from the Cannes Film Festival, and is so enthusiastic about what he saw there, we thought we'd take the time to get a full debriefing. John Powers, welcome back to the States. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, glad to be here.
How good were the films this year?
They were great. It's interesting that this is the 60th anniversary, and I was there for the 50th. And when they had their big 50th anniversary, they had everything going except that the films weren't very good. You know, it wasn't their fault. You know, they had every star in the world come in. There were special fireworks programs and everything,
right.
And the films were lousy. This year, they had the stars, but this year, for some reason, the films were just extraordinarily good from top to bottom. You know, there are usually 20-odd films in competition. And what happens most of the time is people spend most of the festival saying, how did that film get into competition? You know, they'll say that of like 15 of the 20 films.
Mm-hmm.
This year, maybe people thought that of one or two. You know, that it was so strong that even the movies that you didn't like, you thought, well, that's actually a pretty interesting movie, even though I didn't like it.
And sometimes if you have good film years, you have bad judge years. What's your assessment of the judging panel that made the decisions on what films won things?
Okay, well, I think what's interesting to me about this is that I spend every year, probably like most people spend at the Oscars, saying, I can't believe that thing won.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that normally I just can't believe the jury of nine people could be so wrong. This year, strangely enough, the jury chose almost everything that I liked, but not just that I liked, that almost everybody else liked. I mean, it's really an odd thing because normally there are all these weird agendas going on, you know, where something might be the best film, but in fact the jury has a lot of people from Europe and they want to make sure Europe wins.
Mm-hmm.
So that in fact the third or fourth best film wins because it's from Europe. This year they had a jury headed by Stephen Frears, the director, with four actresses on it, including Toni Collette and Sarah Polley. And one of the funny things about it, and this reveals something about the way film critics are, is that we were all faintly condescending going into the festival about the fact there are going to be four actresses on the jury. And we all thought, you know, actors and actresses, like, they can't be trusted. Their judgment's terrible. But in fact, all these actresses brought up the best list I've ever seen.
Oh, wow. Well, the winner this year was a film from Romania, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. What's your assessment of that one?
It's a wonderful film. It's a really terrific film. And what's interesting about it is this is a film that nobody wanted to go to see. I mean, it was always described as the Romanian abortion film. And what it's about are two young college-age women arranging to get an abortion in the Romania of 1987 when abortion was illegal. And it sounds so dreary. I mean, the combination of illegal abortion and communist Romania is enough to scare off almost anybody. But the story proceeds like a combination of social drama, horror film, and thriller. And as you follow these two women, in particular the friend of the woman getting the abortion, the action is unbelievably exciting and incredibly revealing about what it was like in the days when people actually had to go to fly-by-night people to get abortions. And as you're watching it, the film is almost perfectly turned. It has a superb lead performance by an actress named Anna Maria Marinka, who's just splendidly good at conveying what it's like helping your friend get her abortion, even as the friend is passively, aggressively selling you out in all sorts of small ways. And what's interesting about the film is that it's not really about abortion, but more about how the process of getting the abortion changes the life of the woman who helps her friend.
Wow. And so I guess the title, 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, is the term of the pregnancy to this point.
Yes, it's the term of the pregnancy, which actually makes it rather late, which is actually one of the complications in the story, and which is one reason why I think this film will probably be very controversial when it plays in the United States. And it will play in the United States because it won Cannes and is a good film. But in fact, there's no question here about the morality of the procedure. The whole thing is just about how they go about doing it and how it affects them. And I can imagine that there's going to be a lot of controversy from the anti-abortion forces when this film comes out, because in fact it's very tough and not at all sentimental about what it means to abort someone in the fourth month. In fact, it's rather grisly and nasty, and the film shows you that. So that in fact I can imagine people being really interested by this film and there being lots of debates around it.
Was anything else that politically sensitive?
There's been a huge sea change. You know, 2 or 3 years ago at Cannes, all the discussion had to do with Iraq, and it was kind of obligatory for people to bash the United States for being at war in Iraq. You know, now that the war has gone badly enough that Europe is kind of forgetting about it, they're more obsessed with their own problems. I mean, one of the touchstones of this was that although Michael Moore's film was hugely successful, he wasn't as big a deal this time. He was there with his film Sicko, which is his film about America's health system. And it was rapturously received, but this was a case where it was only about America, whereas when he was there with Fahrenheit 9/11, which actually won the festival, he was treated as a kind of god. You know, because here was an American saying how awful America is, and Europeans were eating that up. Whereas here, they just liked the movie.
But in this movie, wasn't he comparing different nations' types of health care and being positive to France? And I would think that would play fairly well in France.
Well, no, one reason why the Europeans loved it was that it actually did suggest that their social services are better than America's. But in fact, it wasn't really so much of an America-bashing movie as sort of a sad about America movie. And what's very smart about the movie, and I think it's his best movie,
really?
Is that Michael Moore does two things that are very smart. The first thing he does is he says, this isn't a film about people who don't have any insurance. It's about people who think they're covered. So the first thing he's doing is saying, this isn't just about poor people. This is about everybody who thinks they have a health system.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second thing he does is he says, let's take seriously the idea of actually having a state-run health insurance company. Once you do that, let's look at the things people have said about national health insurance as a criticism. And so what he does is he takes the various things you might object to. Oh, you don't get very good care. Or that, in fact, the doctors have to go broke to do it. And then he goes to different countries. He goes to Canada and to Great Britain and to France and deals with each of these issues and basically goes and asks patients, how do they feel their care is? You know, he goes to doctors and says, do you feel poor? And then you go to the doctor's house where he lives in this huge estate and he's actually making $1 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, no, he doesn't feel poor, but he wouldn't want to be on a system like ours where the health care is determined by financial organizations like insurance companies. It's a very smart movie in that way, extremely entertaining. And, you know, to my delight, he's not in it very much.
I know what you mean by that, even without it being an insult to Michael Moore.
Oh, it is. Well, I mean, it's partly an insult to Michael Moore. You know, and you know, one of the funny things about the Michael Moore image around the world is that if you're in Europe, they think, and you hear people say, "Well, they really let Michael Moore show this movie." And you know, if you're an American, you're thinking, "I see Michael Moore every 2 minutes." You know, this is the least suppressed guy in the history of the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's kind of nice to see a lower key thing that isn't particularly a Bush bashing movie. You know, it doesn't feel cheap. You know, there's one bad section, I think, where he goes to Cuba to make the point that the Cuban healthcare system is actually fairer and in some ways better than the American healthcare system. Which might be a reasonable point, except he has some idealized photos of grinning Cubans, kind of like he had the grinning Iraqis during Saddam's period in Fahrenheit 9/11. I think he just can't help himself in doing that. That kind of left-wing habit just dies hard. There's a little bit of propaganda in it.
So it's Cuban propaganda that he's doing for Cuba?
Oh, he is. It's just that, you know, that he takes a very funny idea, which is to say, here are some people who were injured during 9/11 or cleaning up after 9/11, and they can't get care. The first thing he does is he says, I'm going to take them to the Guantanamo prison because, in fact, the health care system for the Al-Qaeda suspects is better.
Oh.
And he very wittily tries to get them in so they can get the same health care as the Al-Qaeda suspects, which is a very clever thing to do. But they, you know, the government won't let them in, so they go to Cuba. And that's when he starts talking about the Cuban healthcare system. And what seems to be a reasonable point at first, you know, it just gets sentimental and has too many grinning Cubans. And it seems all a little too beatific. You know, politically, I think it's a mistake because it will allow his enemies to say he's idealizing Cuba. And in fact, that's only a very small part of the movie. I think almost anybody who has healthcare would be interested in this movie, because it really is extraordinarily touching and scary. Because the whole point is, no matter how much you think you have, the healthcare system can get you.
How do you think it's going to do in the States? I mean, if he's the most popular nonfiction filmmaker, do you think that he's going to be able to top himself at the box office?
I don't know that Sicko can beat Fahrenheit 9/11 just because the war unleashed all sorts of feelings. I think it'll be a huge hit. It's an extremely entertaining movie. And I think it'll probably turn out to be an important movie as you head into next year's election. And part of what will make it important is that it doesn't seem nearly so much to be a Democratic film as the last one did. I mean, the last one was so clearly an attack on the Bush administration, whereas here, both parties are rather guilty of letting our health system get to the state that it's in, that I think it will actually have a broader audience than the last one. And as I say, it's extremely funny and quite touching.
Okay. Another thing that's high profile over here in terms of the movies is the one starring Angelina Jolie as Marianne Pearl, who was the widow of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. How did that go over, and what was your opinion of it?
It went over surprisingly well. I somehow had a sense that people thought it was going to be a real bomb because it's – once again, it's one of those films that you're not really sure you want to see. You know, do I want to see the film about the wife of a reporter who was beheaded by monsters? And, you know, the answer is, you know, on the face of it, I don't want to see it. But when I got there, it actually gripped me and held me all the way through. I mean, the interesting thing about it is that even though it's about Marianne Pearl, she's the center of the film, and Angelina Jolie is playing her, but most of the film is more like a Michael Mann movie. It's a very procedural guy film as they're trying to – as they're following how Daniel Pearl got grabbed mm-hmm. and then trying to capture the people who caught him. So that actually Marianne Pearl is more off to the side than you think she's going to be. You know, meanwhile, she kind of strolls through the movie a bit like a movie star in the sense that because her husband has been grabbed, no one dares say no to her. And that, in fact, that, you know, she's treated with kid gloves through the entire thing. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think, the kind of role that Angelina Jolie would know how to play. And she certainly goes for it. I mean, I think the one problem is that I personally find Angelina Jolie's so vast a screen presence, which is distinct from, say, being an actress, that it's very hard to see her playing somebody you know as a real person, because even when she's acting well, she's just so Angelina Jolie that, you know, you feel like she should be on Mount Olympus mm-hmm. rather than in some apartment someplace. I mean, I think it's – for me, that's the most interesting thing about her career is, like, how do you find roles that seem big enough for her? Because, I mean, somehow she just pops on the screen. When she's there, she just – you're watching her and nothing else.
There's some really exciting names, and the little word that has trickled back is very puzzling. The Coen brothers have done a film that sounds darker than what they've done before. Gus Van Sant has one that sounds beautiful, and Quentin Tarantino sounds like he didn't impress anybody. What can you tell us about those films?
Well, I think the great joke for Americans was that was watching the Tarantino film, which had been very well reviewed in the United States, just be hated by the Europeans. You know, they thought it was completely worthless. You know, why would a person make a film like this? It's just girls talking in a car chase. They didn't like it at all. You know, and you know, so it's actually kind of funny because normally Tarantino is the god of Cannes, and this year people were just saying he's all over. He's crazy. This is worthless. But the films they liked were, as you say, the Coen brothers film. And it, the Coen brothers film, which is a good film, it's an adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's novel called No Country for Old Men. And it basically follows the story of a guy who finds some money. He's played by Josh Brolin, who then is being pursued by a genuinely terrifying psychopathic killer played by Javier Bardem, who is in turn being pursued by Woody Harrelson and Tommy Lee Jones.
Wow.
And it's a superb cast, and it features some sequences so exciting that not only was my heart pounding as I watched it, I actually had a nightmare about it when I went to bed that night. And, you know, Javier Bardem, who didn't win Best Actor at the festival when he should have, has come up with probably the scariest psycho killer, you know, in a long, long time. I mean, it's so spooky. It's not like – and it's not like Hannibal Lecter, who's sort of a psychopathic relief serial killer. Mm-hmm. You know, when you put him in the movie, it's supposed to be sort of fun. Whereas Bardem's sort of fun, but he's genuinely disturbingly evil. And, you know, his weight really sticks with you. And the film is about partly the persistence of evil and good people trying to deal with the fact that evil is powerful and persistent and almost in a dark kind of way demonic. And so the film, you know, has a force and a seriousness that their other films don't have.
It sounds like you liked it a lot.
I liked it better than any Coen film I've ever seen. You know, I'm not a huge fan of theirs. So it must be said that some people who like their other things, you know, don't like it so much. But I think on the whole, it was one of the two best received films at the festival, the other one being 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. I mean, it was very highly received. And I think the reason it didn't win anything probably had to do more with the jury deciding it was going to reward the things that didn't start off with famous American directors and big movie stars. That's actually what I think probably happened.
Okay. And what about Gus Van Sant's Paranoid Park?
Yes. Well, Gus Van Sant's film is almost the direct antithesis of it. It's small, elliptical, extremely beautiful, almost avant-garde. And it tells the simplest imaginable story. It's about a young guy who likes to go skateboarding in this slightly dodgy park, skateboarding area known as Paranoid Park. And one evening he gets involved with a couple older guys and he accidentally winds up killing somebody. And it is quite accidental. And that's the whole story. And what it's about is trying to capture the interior life of this young guy and what he dreams of, because he's not very articulate or very expressive. So we keep getting images that are actually going through his head of what he thinks of as being exciting or transcendent. And at the same time, we get a sense of the social world in which he lives, in particular a world where there is no such thing as adult guidance. You know, so that as he shows the kids with their parents, you never see a parent standing there intact as an actor. They're always either out of focus or you only see part of their bodies. It's a very delicate, subtle thing. You know, it's in some sense probably the smallest miniature at the festival. You know, and this is at a festival, you know, where lots of countries like Japan specialize in miniatures. But I think the Van Sant movie is this pure mood piece, and it's extraordinarily ephemeral and delicate. I mean, when they showed the first screening, the projector broke, and there was a break in it. And you could actually feel the air go out because, in fact, it kind of transports you in a hypnotic way.
Uh-huh.
And you realize that this is one of those movies that's so delicate that it's really hard on it to actually have a break of even 30 seconds. Because it just pulls you along on gossamer wings.
Now, I know that when that film was brought to the festival, it didn't even have a distributor. Has that changed?
Yes. The Van Sant film now does have a distributor, I think, and will be coming out, I believe, this fall.
Oh, good.
You know, it will be in lots of other festivals. What's interesting, actually, when you talk about distribution, is that one of the frustrating things about Cannes in some years is that you'll see very good films and you'll think, well, that one will never play in America. Whereas this year, almost all the things that are good will get distribution because they're enough better, they have something going for them, and that everybody was excited about them. So virtually everything got picked up that was good, which is a really exciting thing, because one of the things that I get to do that many Americans don't get to do is see what's going on out in the world in movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, I mean, you know, we're living in a time when we're told that the outside world matters more to us than ever before. Yet, strangely, in some ways, it's harder to have movies come to your theater that are from outside the United States. And so it's actually a great thing when a festival like Cannes is so strong that maybe 15 of the competition films come over. And they are coming from South Korea or Russia, or they're the little Gus Van Sant film that is such a delicate mood piece that, you know, sometimes it might not get released at all.
Were there any trends this year that you noticed?
Well, there were two big trends. The first of them was the triumph of women. and it must be said that this has to be put in the context of the fact that Cannes is traditionally a boys' club. You know, there's only been one woman who's ever won Cannes. And this year, for their 60th anniversary, they were asking international filmmakers to do three-minute films for a compilation called Each to His Own Cinema. And of the 35 people who did them, one was a woman. And it was the same woman who'd won Cannes, Jane Campion. Okay. So starting from that, the way the festival actually turned out is that a huge number of the most important films of the festival were women-dominated. 4 months, 3 years, and 2 days was a great women's film. Marjane Satrapi's animated feature called Persepolis, about a young woman growing up in Iran, you know, won a prize, was supremely good. You know, it will be a big hit here in the United States, I think, as well, because it's just a great story. There was a South Korean film, and the actress in it won the Best Actress Prize, about a woman whose child is kidnapped and how she deals with her grief. And it's this lacerating performance, this just an amazingly great performance. You know, and all the way through the festival, the most interesting things seem to either be by women, starring women, or somehow to do with women, which was very interesting because, as I say, Cannes is not famous for that.
Was there anything else that you noticed, whether it was a coincidence or a trend that was building in the movies you saw this year?
Yes. Well, I think the other big thing that's happening is, I guess, some sort of idea of globalization in cinema. Because it's really interesting how many films either had to do with people crossing borders or were themselves films in which people crossed borders. So one of the most interesting films I saw was a film set in Paris made by this great Taiwanese director named Ho Hsiao-hsien. And his film is set in Paris and is about Parisians. And in fact, it turned out to be a really, really good film. Similarly, the opening night film called My Blueberry Nights, which many people were disappointed by, is by the Hong Kong director Wong Kar-wai, who made 2046 and a bunch of others. He's a huge international favorite. This was his first film in English, and it was made in America and takes place in New York and Memphis and Las Vegas. And then you have – and in film after film, you would see this process that either the films are about people crossing borders or people crossing borders to make the films. And you realize, oh, that actually is the great story of our time, is people crossing over borders to do things. You know, that, you know, I remember Salman Rushdie writing years ago that immigration was the great story of the 20th century. And it seems to me now to be an even greater story in all sorts of interesting ways.
So do you think that those films will touch certain nerves in the U.S. because it's such a hot topic here right now?
Well, I think actually what's nice about the films is that they make immigration seem appealing and they show you the good things that come from there being immigration. You know, to get back to the film called Persepolis, which I've mentioned earlier, what's so fascinating to me about it is it's a film that celebrates France eventually because the heroine of it, you know, grows up in Tehran and eventually winds up in France, and it's only in France that she finds freedom. By finding her freedom in France, she then makes probably the best film by any French person in the festival, even though she's Iranian.
Because we're talking about politics in film and stuff like that. When that was shown at Cannes, was there a sense of how it might be received back in its home country? Was there any of the sense of the stuff that has just happened recently where the country of Iran has basically denounced the film and denounced, you know, the woman who made it? Or was none of that even entered internationally at the festival?
No, we all knew that the Iranian government was going to hate the film. And in fact, we knew it so much that it was actually built into some of the questions that were asked of its creator, Marjane Satrapi. I remember one critic said, "Are you worried that this film in its depiction of Iran will actually help the Bush administration in demonizing Iran in order to go to war?" And she said, "Not at all. The Iranian people are great people. You know, there are issues with the government, but in fact, if you watch the film, you realize that the Iranian people are a good, big-hearted people and that, you know, they're having problems, but in fact, it's a great culture." And in fact, the film does show that, but at the same time, we all knew that the Iranian government wouldn't like the way the country was depicted, or in particular, the way that fundamentalist Islam was depicted by the film.
So this is sort of like filmmakers saying we're citizens, or we are looking at citizens of these various countries, and don't judge us necessarily by our leaders.
Yes, what Satrapi does think is that you should never judge any country by the policies of the government until you know more about it. And the film is so loving in its portrayal of ordinary Iranian people that I do think that when you watch it, you will think, oh yes, they're a lot like us, rather than these are demons who must be destroyed.
And finally, we've spent this whole time talking about movies that you liked. Did you see anything that you really didn't like?
Yes. The worst film of the competition, of the entire festival for me, was an American film called We Own the Night by this guy named James Gray, who the Cannes people, I think of as their discovery. And it's basically the most routine cop brother movie imaginable. You know, Joaquin Phoenix plays a guy who's involved in bad business. Mark Wahlberg plays his honorable cop brother. And then eventually the bad brother becomes the good brother and the two of them fight the Russian mafia. And it is so riddled with stupidity and cliches that the American and English audience or English press couldn't wait for it to end so we could all get up and boo, which in fact we did. The great
You boo at these screenings?
Oh, of course. You know, part of the fun of it is that unlike real life where people are restrained, here people boo or hiss or applaud wildly. You know, or sometimes they do one of the most famous things at Cannes is there are certain seats that really pop up hard. So if someone's offended by something, you hear this thwack and you realize that somebody is very prominently walking out of the screening. So we were booing the James Gray film, and it was a lot of fun to boo. And as we left, you could overhear that the French and Italian critics were kind of liking it. And that they thought it was really good. The same people who had disliked Quentin Tarantino's film Half of Grindhouse and thought it was vacuous loved this movie and thought it was pure cinema and a masterpiece. You know, and we were all flabbergasted. And I remember saying to somebody that it made me proud to be an American. You know, because in America we knew that this movie was no good, whereas in France they actually thought it was a work of brilliance. And so it was just bad in the kind of ways that every TV cop show in America is bad.
Hey, not every TV cop show.
No, actually the example I would give, because I'm a great fan of some TV cop shows, is that you would think that The Wire had never existed.
Okay.
Watching this show, because it's so riddled with good cop, bad cop cliches, evil mobsters with no dimension whatsoever. You know, family cops with no dimension whatsoever, that you think this is a film from 1935 that's been transposed to the present day but made with less good technique.
Hey, thanks for doing this. This is, I think, the first time on Fresh Air that even though I'm guest hosting, that it's like two of us as critics have gotten to sort of bat the ball back and forth. I had a good time.
No, so did I. Thanks for having me.
John Powers, our critic at large. He just returned from the Cannes Film Festival.